नमस्कार। ओम नमो भगवते श्री अरुणाचल रमणाय। Today I've got various questions. The first question I've been asked to answer is was asked by TV Murali. The question is, as per Ramana's teachings, what is the meaning of the word paricca? How does this affect the seeker? Please explain with a practical example for a spiritual seeker. The word paricca means para icca. A para in this context means other, in other words, other people. And icca is will. So paricca is according to the will of others. Bhagavan very seldom used this word. He referred to it in a few places. It's been recorded in one place in talks and in a few places in letters from Sri Ramanashram. In all the contexts where Bhagavan is recorded using this word, it is talking about the prarabdha of the jnani. So the first thing we need to understand is that according to Bhagavan, for the jnani, there is actually no prarabdha. This he makes clear in verse 33 of Uludhunapadu. What he says in verse 33 of Uludhunapadu is saying that Sanchitta and Agamya do not adhere to the jnani, but prarabdha does remain, is a reply said to the questions of others. Just as any of the wives do not remain unwidowed when the husband has died, no, but when the doer has died, all three karmas cease to exist. This echoes what Bhagavan says in verse 38 of Uludhunapadu, in which he says, if we are the doer of actions, that is what he said in Tamil, vinay mudal namayin vilepayan tupom. If we are a doer of action, we will experience the resulting fruit. Vinay mudal a indru vinavi tanne arya. When one knows oneself by investigating who is the doer of action, kartrutvam poi, doership will depart, karmam mundrum karalam, all the three karmas will slip off. Nittamam muktinile, this is the state of liberation which is eternal. So according to Bhagavan, that is all the three karmas, agamya, sanchitta, and prarabdha, these are all only for ego. And so long as we rise as ego, we identify ourselves as a body and mind. And since we identify ourselves as a body and mind, since any actions done by body, speech, or mind are experienced by us as actions done by us. So doership is the very nature of ego. So long as we rise as ego, we experience ourselves as a doer of actions and consequently as the experiencer of the resulting fruit. We experience the fruit as our prarabdha. But when we know what we actually are, ego would thereby be eradicated. And in the absence of ego, there's no sense of doership and no sense of experiencership. And therefore, all the three karmas cease to exist because these three karmas only exist for ego. This is why Bhagavan said, compares them to three wives. The three wives are sumangali, so long as the husband is alive, but they all three of them become widowed when the husband dies. So you can't have you can't if the husband dies, it's not that two wives become widowed and one remains unwidowed. All three are widowed. So likewise, when ego is destroyed, all the three karmas cease to exist. But as Bhagavan says, it is sometimes said that though Sanchitta and Agamya do not adhere to the jnani, prarabdha does remain. But though it is said so, as Bhagavan says, this is a reply said to the questions of others. What Bhagavan means here by others, vetra, is those who are not ready or not willing or able or who are not willing to understand his teaching, because his teachings are very, very simple. All three karmas are only for ego. When ego dies, the jnani is egoless. If the jnani, as Bhagavan often used to say, jnana me jnani, jnana alone is the jnani. That is, when ego dies, what remains is only jnana, and jnana alone knows jnana. So jnana alone is the jnani. So for jnana, there are no karmas, because there's no doership. The nature of jnana is just being, not doing. It is sat-chit, being awareness. So that's our real nature. So karmas exist for us only when we rise as ego. But for those who are not willing to, understand this simple fact, they see vijnani not as, I mean, so long as we take ourselves as a body, vijnani also seems to be a body. We see Bhagavan as if he were a person like us, with body and mind and so on. So in our view, since vijnani seems to be a person, seems to be a body, there seems to be prarabdha for vijnani. But that's only a seeming prarabdha, and it's only in the view of others. For vijnani, there is no prarabdha whatsoever. But often in sastras and other texts, explanations have to be given for those who are not having a deeper understanding. And for them, the jnani seems to be a person. And then they ask, why did the jnani do this? Why did the jnani do that? Simple answer, it's all prarabdha. But that prarabdha is only for the body of the jnani, not for the jnani. The jnani's experience is, I alone am. The jnani is never aware of itself as, I am this body. So, so long as there is a body for vijnani, there is a seeming prarabdha for that body. And it's in this context that subject of three types of prarabdha, svecha, parecha, and anicca. Svecha means one's own will. Parecha means other person's will. And anicca means not the will of any person. So sometimes prarabdha is classified as these three types of prarabdha, but this is really not a classification that need concern us, because the law of karma, as taught by Bhagavan, is very, very simple. The actions we do under the sway of our vasanas are agamya. Those agamya bear fruit. Those fruit get stored in sanchitta. We don't experience the fruit in this lifetime. They all get stored in sanchitta. And from sanchitta, for each lifetime, God or Guru selects a certain portion as prarabdha. So the prarabdha is the fruit of actions that we've done in the past with our will. So according to this, classifying prarabdha as svecha, parecha, and anicca is irrelevant. It's really not useful, because ultimately whatever prarabdha we experience is the fruit of our own actions that we did by our own will. But the context in which this classification is usually made, and the context in which all the places where it's recorded that Bhagavan used this term parecha, it was with respect to the seeming prarabdha of the jnani. In talks, as I say, there's just one reference. The reference in talks is not at all clear. I mean, what is recorded here, it's obviously not a complete recording of what Bhagavan said. That is, someone asked Bhagavan a question. This is in talk section 385 on the 6th of April, 1937. Some person, Mr. Venkata Rao, asked Bhagavan, should we not learn the jnani's ways and imitate them? And Bhagavan is recorded as replying, it's of no use. Vasanas are of four kinds. Then he tells about four kinds of vasanas, which are related to four classifications of different types of jnani. But again, this is all related to the outward appearance. Jnana is one and indivisible. So there are no four different types of jnani, but it seems so according to the outward mode of life of a jnani. So he gives an explanation about that. And then he says their fruit. In this context, their fruits implies the fruits of the vasanas. But it's not, the prarabdha is not the fruits of vasanas. It is the fruits of the actions that we've done under the sway of our vasanas. So only in very, usually we don't refer to prarabdha as the fruit, we refer to it as karmapala, the fruit of action. Those actions that we did under the sway of our vasanas. So in that sense, we can say the vasanas, they're the fruit of vasanas, but that's not how it's usually expressed. And I think, as I say, this is not... What has been recorded here is not the full explanation given by Bhagavan. But anyway, it was recorded here that Bhagavan said, their fruits are reaped in three ways, of our own will, svecha, by others' will, parecha, and involuntarily, anicca. That's all that's said about it in talks. In letters from Sri Ramanasham, it's given a bit more, in a bit more detail. In one place, or in the 48th letter on the 3rd of June 1946, in answer to some question about papa and punya and so on, Bhagavan says, prarabdha is of three categories, icha, anicca, and parecha. For him who has realized his self, there is no icha prarabdha, the two others, anicca and parecha, remain. But as I say, this is as Bhagavan says in Uludanaptu Anabandham verse 33, that I read earlier, this is, as Bhagavan says, this is just a reply given to the questions of others. So for those who take Vijnani to be the body and therefore who believe Vijnani has prarabdha, it has to be said that prarabdha is anicca or parecha. It's not the Jnani's will, it's according to the will of others. So this is one reference. A later reference is in letter 116 on the 17th of May 1947. Bhagavan was asked a question. Swami, you said yesterday that a jnani will perform such actions as are ordained according to his prarabdha, but it is said that no, that jnanis have no prarabdha at all. And Bhagavan replied, how did they get this body if they have no prarabdha? How do they perform the various actions? The actions of the jnanis are, themselves are called prarabdhas. It is stated that there is prarabdha from Brahma right up to Sadashiva and the avatars of Rama and Krishna and others also. And then he quotes Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 8, in which it is said, for the protection of the good and for the destruction of the evildoers, for the sake of firmly establishing Dharma, I am born from age to age. And then Bhagavan continues to explain, as stated in this sloka, Ishwara assumes a shape when the virtues of good people and the sins of bad people mingle and become prarabdha, and he has to establish dharma. That is called parecha prarabdha. The body itself is prarabdha. The purpose for which that body has come into existence will get done of its own accord. So what Bhagavan is here using this term parecha prarabdha in connection with this verse of the Bhagavad Gita. That is, Krishna says he's born from age to age. Why is he born? For protection of the good, for destruction of the evildoers, and for the sake of establishing dharma. So who wants the good to be protected? Who wants the evildoers to be destroyed? Who wants dharma to be established? It's the good people. So God is born in answer to the prayers of good people who want righteousness in this world. That is the implication. So the seeming prarabdha of Vijnani is parecha prarabdha. In other words, why... Let's take Bhagavan, for example. Why was did Bhagavan appear in this world? He appeared in answer to our prayers. Because we were struggling in this samsara, in this bondage, we want to know the way to escape from the miseries of our present state. So because many good people, or good people means people who are aspiring to be to go beyond samsara, have prayed, he has appeared in this form. That's the seeming prarabdha of his body is paraicha prarabdha. That's all we need to understand. There's also a couple more references letters. Someone asked in one point, is it a fact that a jnani will not have any prarabdha except paraicha? And Bhagavan more or less confirms that. That's not one that need concern us. And then again, later on, in connection with the same sloka of Gita, he refers to paraicha prarabdha. So Bhagavan talks about paraicha prarabdha only when questions about the prarabdha of a jnani arise. But Bhagavan's deeper teaching is that for the jnani, there is no prarabdha at all. It's only if we take the jnani to be the body that there seems to be a prarabdha for that jnani. And that prarabdha is the result of what? It's not the result of any karma is done by the jnani, because the jnani is not a non-doer. The jnani is just being jnani. Jnana may jnani. Jnana alone is a jnana. Jnani. And what is jnana? Jnana is sat. It's just being. So for the jnani, as Bhagavan says in the 15th paragraph of Nana, he's talking about Ishwara. But what he says about Ishwara is equally applicable to the jnani, but the jnani sankalpa rahita. He's devoid of sankalpas. And therefore devoid of karma. Yes, what he says here, sorry, the bit I was trying to refer to it is this one. He says about God, oru karmamum avare otadu, not even a single karma attaches itself to him. Likewise with Vinyani, because Vinyani is none other than God, and God is none other than Vinyani. Not a single karma attaches itself to him. Why? Because his nature is just being, not doing. But because in our view, the jnani seems to be the body, so that body seems to have a prarabdha. What is that prarabdha is the result of what? It's a result of the will of others. It's a result of our prayers, because we are struggling in this samsara, unable to get out of it. We are unable to know how to get out of this miserable state in which we've got caught. He has appeared in answer to our prayers to tell us to turn within and to know what we actually are. So that is what we need to understand about the sense in which paraicha is required. Whatever prarabdha Bhagavan seems to have, he took this name and form, that Arunacharya Shiva himself appeared in the form of Bhagavan Ramana in answer to our prayers, because Arunacharya is always teaching in silence. But we are unable to understand that silent teaching of Arunachala. So it was necessary in answer to our prayers, for Arunachala to appear in the form of Bhagavan Ramana to tell us in words what he's always teaching us in silence, namely, Tirumbi aham, turning within, Tane dinamahakankan, see yourself daily and constantly with the inner eye. Terium, it will be known. Endraneya Arunachala. Bhagavan sings in verse 44 of Arunachakshramulai. That is what Arunachala taught Bhagavan in silence, and Bhagavan teaches us in words. Turn within, see yourself, and you will know the truth. And when you know the truth, the ego will be destroyed and all three karmas will come to an end. So I hope that adequately answered that question about paraicha. This is the only question that remained from the last meeting we had last month, but there are some other questions that I was sent by Dr. Anand, the ashram president, in December of last year. because at that time I gave a talk in connection with Bhagavan's Jayanti celebration, the international celebration of Bhagavan Jayanti at that time. I actually talked about uniqueness of Bhagavan teachings, so I didn't answer these questions. But anyway, he had sent me these questions in case I wanted to answer them. Ever since then, I've had in mind that I should try and answer these questions, but I've never had time to do so. So this is a good opportunity to answer some of them. So I'll begin to go through them one by one. The first question is, what is the significance of the heart center in Bhagavan's teachings? Is it fair to say that until one has had some experience, however vague, of the heart center, one cannot grasp the full import of Bhagavan's core teachings, the Hridaya Vidya? According to Bhagavan, heart means the center. Heart is, we are self of the heart. Heart is our real nature. Heart is nothing other than our, than what we actually are is the heart. And it is that from which everything emerges and into which everything subsides. And it is that in which everything is contained. This is very clearly expressed by Bhagavan, for example, in the second verse of Arunacha Pancharatnam. In the Sanskrit version, Bhagavan sings, Tvai Arunachala Sarvam Bhutva Stitva Pralinamay Tachitram Hyam Hridi Aham Iti Atmataya Nityasi Boste Vadanti Hridiyam Nama. That means, in you, Arunachala, all this picture comes into existence, is sustained and is destroyed. As you yourself dance in the heart as I, as oneself, you dance in the heart as I. For you, they say, the name is heart. And he said the same in Tamil in a slightly more expanded way. In Tamil, he says, Chittirama mikdellam semalaye nimbale uttidamai nindre odungidamal nityamum na nendride na dittiduva yalumpe tanideum endriduva tam. That means, Red Hill, he addresses Arunachala as Red Hill, all this, meaning the entire world appearance, which is a picture, it's a mental picture, it's a mental fabrication, just like in a dream we see a world, but this world we see in the waking stage is just like the world we see in the dream. It's just a mental fabrication, a mental picture. So all this arises, stands, and subsides only in you. Since you dance eternally in the heart as I, they say your name is heart, your name itself is heart. That is Arunachala. When Bhagavan says you dance eternally in the heart as I, when he says in the heart, there he's referring to heart as in the center of our existence, he dances as I. Since he is I, he is himself the heart, that is, there is no heart other than I. So here Bhagavan clearly implies that what he means by the term heart is that which is always shining within us as I. What is shining within us as I? That is the heart, that is Arunachala, that is our Atmaswarupa, our own real nature, that is Brahman, whatever we want to call it. But that is what Bhagavan means by the word heart. However, in some contexts, Bhagavan referred to a place two digits to the right from the center of the chest at the heart. But we need to understand the context in which this happened. That is, when Bhagavan used the word heart, he's talking not about any place in time or space. He's talking about the very center of everything, the center in which everything is included. In other words, our own real nature. What he refers to in this verse as Arunachala. But some people who can't help but think in terms of a body, people whose minds are much soaked in ideas picked up from yoga and so on, they question Bhagavan, this heart you talk about, is this the same as the Anahata Chakra? So Bhagavan said, no, it is not the Anahata Chakra. Then they said, if it's not the Anahata Chakra, then where in the body is it? Bhagavan then sometimes explained that relative to this body, the point in this body that seems to be the center of our self experience is 2 digits to the right from the center of the chest. And Bhagavan illustrated this with some examples. He said, for example, if you ask some school children, who can do this sum correctly? If a boy is able to do the sum, he won't point to his head and say, I can do the sum correctly. He'll point to his chest and say, I can do the sum correctly. Or if you ask the children, who's willing to run to the shop to fetch the newspaper? One boy may stand up and say, I'll run and fetch it. But where does he point? He doesn't point at his legs that are going to do the running. He points at his chest. So for all of us, when we refer to ourselves, we point at our chest, just to the right, because this is relative to this body. This is where we feel ourselves to be centered. And all emotions, we refer to emotions as emotions coming from the heart, but it's not referring to the blood pumping vessel on the left-hand side of the chest. It's actually referring to this point 2 digits to right from the center of the chest. And we can observe this at other times. Supposing you suddenly hear a loud sound, you're walking down the street, for example, and suddenly a car honks its horn just behind you, or suddenly some drumming, very loud drumming happens, or there's a sudden explosion nearby. We feel a shock. If you observe at that time, you'll find a sensation 2 digits to right from the center of the chest. We can also occasionally find this. When we turn our attention within, we may also sometimes feel a sensation there. That is because that is the point in the body from which everything spreads, from which relative to the body only. So sometimes Bhagavan said, the point in the body from which the awareness eye begins to spread is that point 2 digits to the center, to the right from the center of the chest. And he said the Sushumna Nadi, which is usually said to go up from the heart to the head, to the Sahasrara, from the Muladhara, from the base of the spine, up to the head, the Sahasrara, Bhagavan says it doesn't stop there. Bhagavan says it's like a question mark. It comes down to this point 2 digits to right from the center of the chest, because when ego rises, the sensation of body, that as soon as we rise as ego, we're aware of ourselves as I am this body. But how does the ego spread through the body? It spreads from this point 2 digits to right from the center of the chest, rises up to the brain, and from there it spreads throughout the body. This usually happens so fast we don't notice it, but if this is something that can be observed if we're going by those who are going very deep in this practice. But all this is unnecessary, that we need not know this. Bhagavan said this only in answer to those who are curious about these things, because Bhagavan's teaching is, I am not this body. So what is the connection between us and this body? It's only ego. How ego connects with this body need not concern us. Our aim is not to investigate this body. Our aim is to investigate the reality of ego. What is the reality of ego? The reality of ego is only I am. That is Atmaswarupa. That is what we are to investigate. So we need not be concerned about this point 2 digits to the right from the center of the chest. Bhagavan makes this very clear in an answer he gave to Swami Natanananda in Swaminathananda recorded in Upadesha Manjari. In chapter 2, question 9 was what Natanananda asked is, what is the swarupa of Hridaya? That was the question he asked. And in answer to that, Bhagavan said, what Bhagavan said, though texts that describe the Hridaya heart say, I mean, he quotes 2 verses of Vuludanapdu Anabandham, which he translated from, that's verses 18 and 19 of Vuludanapdu Anabandham, which he translated from from a Malayali translation of Ashtanga Hridaya, which is an Ayurvedic, it's a medical book, basically. There it describes the heart as being two digits to right from the center of the chest. So Bhagavan says, though it's described in that way in some texts, in Paramatha, in the ultimate truth is, the meaning of the term Hridaya is only Atman. In other words, it's only oneself. Since it is distinguished by the lakshanas, or marks or characteristics, called Sat, Chit, Ananda, existence, awareness, happiness, Nitya, eternal, Purna, fullness, differences such as inside and outside and below and above do not belong to it. In what place all thoughts cease, that motionless place alone is called the state of Atman, oneself. When one abides experiencing its swarupa, its own, its real nature, as it is, there is no place there for investigation such as whether it is either inside or outside the body. So what Bhagavan means by heart is not just this point, two digits to the center of the chest. This is only relative to the body, but the body itself is unreal. What is real is only the heart, which is that, that Satchidananda, as Bhagavan says, it is eternal, it is Purna, so it is that which contains everything, it's the infinite whole, and it is Sat, it is pure being, Chit, pure awareness, and Ananda, pure happiness. So that is what Bhagavan means by the term heart. This question also refers to Bhagavan's core teaching being the Hridaya Vidya. Bhagavan's core teaching, we can call Atmavidya. If we understand Hridaya means only Atman, then yes, Bhagavan's core teaching is Hridaya Vidya. But this term Hridaya Vidya is the name of a chapter in Ramana Gita. In chapter 5 of Ramana Gita is called Hridaya Vidya. But what is said in that chapter is a few of the verses are touching upon Bhagavan's core teachings, but we can't say this chapter is Bhagavan's core teaching. Yet whatever useful ideas are in this chapter are expressed much more clearly and cogently by Bhagavan in texts like Nana and Uludunapadu and so on. So there's nothing in this chapter 5 of Ramana Gita, but we do not find in other texts and express more clearly in other texts. So we shouldn't think that this chapter is the core teaching of Bhagavan. Bhagavan's core teachings are expressed in his own writings, in works like Arunacha Stuti Panchakam, Nana, Uludunapadu, Upadesha Undia, Amma Vidai, Ekamma Panchakam. These are Bhagavan's core teachings. But the question is it fair to say that until one has had some experience, however vague, of the heart center, one cannot grasp the full import of Bhagavan's teachings? Is there anyone who has not had experience of the heart center? We are all aware I am. That which is shining within us as I, that is the heart. So there is never a moment when we are not experiencing the heart. The heart is what we actually are. The heart is ourself. The problem is, though we are always aware I am, in waking and dream, we are not aware just I am. We are aware I am such and such a person. I am Michael, or I am whoever. We identify ourselves with the name and form of a body and take that to be ourselves. The body being the bundle of five sheaths, all the five sheaths. So long as we are aware of ourselves as I am this body, though we are aware of the heart, we are not aware of the heart as it is, because the heart is that fundamental awareness I am. So we are always aware I am, but because of the conflation of this I am with adjunct, the mixture of this I am with adjuncts, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are. So to be aware of ourselves as we actually are, we just need to be aware of ourselves without adjuncts. In other words, we need to be aware of ourselves as just I am, not I am this or I am that. So in order to experience the heart as it is, we need to turn our attention within and attend only to that fundamental awareness of our own existence, I am. That alone is the heart. By holding on to the heart, which is what alone is real, all that is unreal will drop off. All the upadis, the adjuncts are unreal. They will drop off and the heart alone will remain. This is all we need to understand. So if this is our understanding of Hridaya Vidya, yes, that is the core of Bhagavan's teachings. If we understand it in any other way, then it is not. That is, this mention of the heart on the right-hand side of the chest is certainly not Bhagavan's core teaching. It's just an incidental thing that Bhagavan mentioned for those who couldn't help but think in terms of the body. But heart has nothing to do with body. Not only this body, the entire universe appears, stands, and disappears in the heart, as Bhagavan says in that verse of Arunachala Pancharatnam, verse 2 of Arunachala Pancharatnam, where he refers to Arunachala as the heart, and he says, in you, all this, meaning this entire world appearance, this entire picture of the world, it arises, it stands, and it subsides only in you. So everything is in the heart, and the heart is in everything, because the heart alone is what actually exists. The heart is Satchit. So nothing can exist or be known independent of Satchit. So from Satchit, we have risen as ego. What is real in ego is only Satchit, only the fundamental awareness I am. But when we rise as ego, we are aware of ourselves as I am this body. And it's only when we're aware of ourselves as I am this body, but we're consequently aware of everything else. So everything else appears only in the view of ego. And ego appears only in the heart and disappears in the heart. So the heart is the beginning, the middle, and the end. It is the center of all, and that in which everything is contained. So, and we are that, Tattvamasi. So that's what we need to understand about heart. The next question I was asked was, how does it feel when the mind sinks in the heart? I know the scriptures say it's hard to describe, but are there words that could come close to express the feeling? So long as there is any feeling, so long as we are aware of anything other than ourselves, the mind isn't sinking in the heart. But we all experience the mind sinking in the heart every day when we fall asleep. Because what happens when we fall asleep? The mind sinks in the heart. So if you can explain what it feels like to fall asleep, then you can explain what it feels like for the mind to sink in the heart. We can't. Why? Because when the mind here means ego. When the ego subsides back into its source, everything else, which appears only in the view of ego, will subside along with it. And we experience this every day in sleep. When we're too tired to continue thinking, we subside, our attention ceases going outwards, we subside back into the heart. And when ego subsides, everything else subsides along with it. So what remains in sleep? In sleep, we're aware only of the heart. We're aware only I am. We're not aware of anything else other than our own existence. So what we experience in sleep, that is the heart. The subsidence of the mind in sleep is the mind sinking in the heart. The problem with sleep is, it is manolaya, not manonasa. It's a temporary dissolution of mind. As Bhagavan says in verse 13 of Upadeshundia, dissolution of mind is of two kinds, laya and nasa. What is dissolved in laya will rise again. If its form dies in nasa, it will not rise again. So our aim is not the temporary subsidence of mind, not the mind sinking the heart on temporarily, but the mind sinking in the heart permanently. In order for the mind to sink in the heart permanently, we need to, that is, what is the nature of the mind? When we use the term, generally when Bhagavan's talking about mind, he's generally referring to the first thought I, because as he said, of all the thoughts that constitute the mind, the first thought, the root thought, is this thought called I. Because the difference between the thought called I and all other thoughts are jada. Whereas the thought called I, namely ego, is a mixture of chit and jada, chit jada granti. So but it's the thought called I is the only thought that is endowed with awareness. So it's only in the view of ego, the thought called I, that all other thoughts seem to exist. So what the mind essentially is only ego, as Bhagavan says in verse 18 of Upadeshundia. So when ego sinks in the heart, everything else sinks with it, because everything else seems to exist only in the view of ego. In order to bring about a permanent dissolution of mind, a permanent dissolution of ego, we need to know what we actually are. Why is that? Because ego is nothing but a false awareness of ourself. That is, as ego, we are always aware of ourselves as I am this body, and we're consequently aware of the appearance of other things. This is not what we actually are. What we actually are is just that pure awareness, that fundamental awareness, I am. So in order to eradicate ego, since ego is a false awareness of ourself, it can be eradicated only by a correct awareness of ourself. If we see a rope and mistake it to be a snake, the only way to kill that snake, to get rid of that snake, is to see what it actually is. If we look at it very carefully, we say, oh, it's just a rope. Then the snake is thereby removed. The snake is no longer a problem. There never was a snake there. Likewise with ego or mind. We seem to be ego only so long as we're not looking at ourselves. So long as we're attending to other things, we seem to be ego. But when we look at ourselves, ego will subside and dissolve back into its source. And if we look at ourselves so keenly that we thereby become aware, we thereby cease to be aware of everything else and remain aware of ourselves alone, that is the state of pure awareness. And as soon as we as ego experience ourselves as pure awareness, we cease to be ego and remain as pure awareness. That is manonasa, of destruction of the mind. So that is what we need to know. That's what we need. That's our aim. Not the temporary dissolution of mind, but the permanent dissolution of mind. Temporary dissolution of mind is very pleasant. It's very nice every night when we fall asleep. We are relieved for a few hours of all this turmoil of waking and dream. But it's not a permanent solution, because we rise again and again. We will continue rising until we know what we actually are. When we know what we actually are, by investigating ourselves, by turning our attention within and trying to attend only to ourselves, we will continue rising. So we need to in order to put a permanent end to the ego, we need to know what we actually are. When ego sinks into the heart, nothing new is experienced. That is, the question here is, I'm asked to express the feeling. It's not a feeling. That is, when everything drops off, when all other knowledge, all other awareness of anything other than ourselves drops off, that is the sinking of the mind in the heart. What then remains is just what we are always aware of, which is that pure awareness, I am. But though we are always aware of this fundamental awareness, I am, we're not aware of it generally in its pure condition, because we are currently aware of it mixed and conflated with adjuncts. So if you want to know what it feels like for mind to sink in the heart, turn your attention within. To the extent to which we attend to ego, it will subside back into the heart. But we will find when the mind sinks in the heart, that it is not anything new that is experienced. All things that appear and disappear drop off, and what alone always remains, what alone always exists, alone remains. It is like, what does it feel like when the now pictures are being projected on the cinema screen? What does it feel like when the pictures cease being projected on the screen? So long as the pictures are being projected on the screen, we are fascinated by the pictures and we overlook the screen. When the pictures no longer projected on the screen, we see the screen alone. It may seem as if the screen, there's a screen there, as if it's newly appeared, but it hasn't newly appeared. It was always there. That's why Bhagavan says in verse 30 of Uludunapadu, Bhagavan explains this very nicely. Nana ena man ul man manam ul nadi ulum nanave. When the as soon as the mind reaches the heart, inwardly investigating who am I, nanam avan tale nanamura, when he who is I dies, in other words, when ego dies, nanana tondrum ondru tanaha. One thing appears spontaneously as I am I. And then he says in the next sentence, tondrinum, though it appears, nanandru, it is not I, meaning it's not ego. Porul pundrum adu, tanam porul. It is the entire substance. It is the purnavastu, the pundra porul, tanam porul, the substance that is oneself. So that is the reality. So why does he say that it appears spontaneously as I am I? When the projection on the screen, when the projection ceases, it's as if the screen appears. Oh, only when the projection stops do we say, oh, there's just a screen there, nothing more than a screen. Likewise, when ego dies, everything else ceases to exist along with it, and what remains is the screen alone. So momentarily, it seems as if the screen is appearing, but though it appears, it is not actually something that appears and disappears because it was always there. We were always seeing nothing other than the screen. So it hasn't really appeared. It was always appearing. It's only because of the disappearance of everything else, but of the pictures that were projected on it, that the screen seems to exist. Likewise, when ego dies and everything else ceases to exist along with it, what remains is what was always shining as I am. And why does he say that it shines as nan nan, I am I? There's a very a good reason for this. So long as we are aware, as we rise as ego, as the mind, we are always aware of ourselves as I am this or I am that. I am this body, so we always identify ourselves with this or that, some adjuncts. But whatever we identify with is something other than ourselves. So any identification is false. The only true identification is I am I. I am nothing other than myself. I am not anything other than I. So that's what Bhagavan means by I am I. So all the time when we were sitting watching the film in the screen, cinema, we are looking at, what are we looking at? We're looking only at the screen, but we overlook the screen because we are so fascinated by the pictures. When the pictures disappear, when the pictures cease to be projected, then we say, oh, it's just a screen. The screen is the screen. I am I. So we recognize that what was actually there was only a screen. Likewise, when the mind sinks into the heart, reaches the heart by inwardly investigating who am I, ego will die, and and then one thing will appear spontaneously as I am I. But though it seems to appear, it doesn't actually appear because it was always there. It was always shining clearly as I. That's why Bhagavan says in the next sentence, though it appears, it is not I, meaning it's not ego, because the I that appears and disappears is ego. Ego appears in waking and dream and disappears in sleep. But what we actually are, the real I, the substance of ego, that which is always shining in our heart as I am, that is always there, always shining. It's nothing new, but it just seems to appear anew when everything else disappears. So when the mind finally sinks in the heart, the final time, what it will feel like, we will recognize ourselves as we always actually were. And that is not anything new, that because we are always that. There's never a moment when we, as Bhagavan often said, jnana is not a new knowledge to be attained. We are always aware of ourselves. That is, jnana is nothing but that fundamental awareness, I am. All that is necessary is not to know anything new, but to remove all the wrong knowledge. Knowledge of anything other than I am is false knowledge, is wrong knowledge. Remove the wrong knowledge, and then the true knowledge alone remains. How to remove the wrong knowledge? All the wrong knowledge appears only in the view of ego. So ego is the root of all wrong knowledge. It's the false knowledge, I am this body. Investigate ego to see what it actually is, and we will see us that we are just that fundamental awareness, I am. Thereby, the wrong knowledge is removed, the ego is removed, and everything else ceases to exist along with it. And what remains is what always actually exists, namely our own pure being, pure awareness, I am. So I hope that adequately answers that question. The next question I was asked is, do you believe that it is Bhagavan who chooses his devotees? Yes, I think that's undoubtedly the case. We may feel that we have come to Bhagavan, but it's only out of his grace he has chosen us. But remember, Bhagavan is not something other than ourselves. Bhagavan is our own self. So he's choosing us and our choosing him. We have now chosen him as our guru. We have chosen him because he has chosen us. So that is, it is because of his grace that we have been attracted to his teachings, that we have recognized him as our Sadguru, as our true guru. So that is entirely by his grace. So yes, he chooses us. Why has he chosen us and not others? He's actually chosen everyone. But as Bhagavan often used to say, in a lotus pond, there are many lotus buds, but each day only a few of those lotus buds blossom. The others, they haven't blossomed today, but their time will come when they are ready for it. That is, each of the lotus blossoms is in a different state of maturity. So when we reach a certain stage in our spiritual development, we are ready to be attracted to his path. It's at that moment that he chooses us and draws us to his path. So yes, it is him, he who has chosen us. But he has chosen us, why? Because he doesn't see us as other than himself. He sees all, in Bhagavan's view, he alone exists. So he doesn't, why does Bhagavan have love for, we saw in Bhagavan's lifetime, Bhagavan had equal love for all, both for the good people and the bad people, for the for rich people, poor people, for animals, of all varieties. Bhagavan's love was equal to all. Why was it equal to all? Because he loved everyone as himself. Why did he love everyone as himself? Because he saw everyone as himself. He, in his view, there's nothing other than himself. Whatever appears is nothing other than himself. So it's his very nature to choose us. Even long before we were attracted to his path, we were chosen by him. But he has revealed himself to us in the form of Bhagavan Ramana only when we're ready to accept his teachings. So there's not a soul in this world, there's not a soul in all the multiple worlds, there's not a single soul who has not been chosen by him. But he will reveal himself to us, he will draw us to his path when we are ready. So I hope that adequately answers that question. I think I've got a few more. The next question is a very important one. How can we use the experience of deep sleep to gain a clearer understanding of Bhagavan's teachings? We all experience sleep every day, but considering our experience of sleep in the light of Bhagavan's teachings is helps us to understand his teachings, and it also helps us to put his teachings into practice, most importantly. Because what is it? Generally, the normal, if you ask most people about what they experience in sleep, they say, I don't experience anything. I'm not aware in sleep. But that is a superficial, that because they haven't thought deeply about it. We all experience sleep. That is, we are all clearly aware of three states. We are aware there's a state of waking, which we now seem to be in. There's a state of dream. And there's another state, whereas in waking and dream, we're aware of phenomena. In sleep, we are not aware of any phenomena. We're not aware of anything other than our own existence. So sleep is a state we experience. If we didn't experience sleep, we wouldn't know there was such a state at all. We wouldn't be aware of any gap between, it would seem to us that there was just an unbroken chain of alternating states of waking and dream. We'd not be aware of any gap between such states. But we are all clearly aware there is a gap. There are times when we are not awake and we are not dreaming. We're not aware of anything. But we are aware of being in that state in which we are not aware of anything. That's why we can now recall having been in that state. So sleep is a state of pure awareness. We're not aware of anything other than ourselves, but we're clearly aware of ourselves, of our own existence in sleep. So when we are practicing Bhagavan's path, self-investigation, we are trying to know what we actually are. We are investigating our own being, our own existence. And what we actually, now we mistake ourselves to be this bundle of five sheaths, the makeup, the person or body that we now seem to be. But none of these things are actually ourselves. What we actually are is what alone remains in sleep, namely that fundamental awareness of our own existence, I am. So when we are practicing self-investigation, we should be attending to ourselves so keenly that we experience nothing other than what we experience in sleep. In other words, we experience our own existence in its pure and pristine state. When practicing self-investigation, because of the strength of our Vishaya-vasanas, we don't entirely let go of anything, of other things. So we still have a residual awareness of body and world and other things. But what we are aiming for is to be so keenly self-attentive, but we are aware of nothing other than our own being, as we are in sleep. So the closer we come to that, to experiencing what we experienced in sleep and nothing else, the deeper we are going within. So our aim is to go within so deeply, in other words, to attend to ourselves so keenly that we cease to be aware of anything else and remain aware only of our own being. That state in which we're aware of nothing other than our being, nothing other than our own existence, ourself, that is the state of pure awareness. And as soon as we experience that state of pure awareness, ego is thereby destroyed. Because as soon as we recognize ourselves as pure awareness, we can no longer mistake ourselves to be anything else. If you look at the snake carefully enough, you'll see it as a rope. As soon as you see it's a rope, you can never again mistake it to be a snake because you clearly know it's a rope. And so you can see how, why I mistook it to be a snake, because it does look like snake, but you can never again believe that it's a snake. You will never again feel fear because you've clearly seen what it actually is. Likewise, when we are aware of ourselves as we were in sleep, as pure awareness, then ego will cease to exist. Then the question may arise, why then, since we experience that pure awareness every day in sleep, why does ego come again? Why isn't ego destroyed when we fall asleep? There's a reason for it. Sleep is a state of manolaya. The destruction of ego is called manonasa. Manonasa is the state in which ego dissolves by That is, we as ego need to be aware of ourselves as pure awareness. When we're aware of ourselves as pure awareness, when we as ego are aware of ourselves as pure awareness, we cease to be ego. Ego is eradicated. But in the case of sleep, what happens is, because we are too tired to continue thinking, ego subsides. And as a result of ego subsides and dissolves back into its source, as a result of the dissolution of ego, pure awareness alone remains. But because of that pure awareness shines forth only after the dissolution of ego, ego is not thereby destroyed, because you can't destroy something that is not present. It has to be present to destroy it. That is why it's in waking and dream that we need to investigate ourselves and see ourselves as we actually are. We need to be aware of ourselves with pure awareness in the waking and dream states. In other words, we as ego need to be aware of ourselves as we actually are. As soon as the ego is aware of itself as it actually is, it ceases to be ego and remains as it actually is, as pure awareness. So this is what Bhagavan has taught us about sleep is very, very important. Sleep is not a state of non-awareness. Sleep is a state of pure awareness. It's a state of clear awareness. Some people wrongly say, oh, Bhagavan said, but for Vijnani is awake in sleep. Vijnani is aware in sleep. Bhagavan didn't say Vijnani. For Vijnani, there are no three states. There's only that state of pure awareness. Even for the Ajnani, we are Ajnani only in waking and dream. That is, the Ajnani is ego. Ego dissolves in sleep, and what remains in sleep is only pure awareness. So we all experience pure awareness in sleep. Because awareness is our very nature. How could we ever be not aware? So according to Bhagavan, we are all aware in sleep. But because of our outward-looking attention in waking and dream, it seems to us that, oh, I didn't know anything in sleep. Yes, we didn't know anything, in the sense we didn't know any phenomena, but we knew our own being. We were clearly aware of our own existence. That is the only true awareness, is that awareness I am. That is what we always experience throughout all the three states. The problem now is not that we aren't aware I am. We're aware I am, but we're not just aware I am. We're aware I am so-and-so. So we need to remove that adjunct, which we can do only by experiencing ourselves as we actually are, namely as pure awareness, which is what we always experience in sleep. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.